your argument now in the case of Bruno against the United States.
Please, the court. My name is Dave Cupitz, and I'll be representing the plaintiff appellant.
Counsel?
There are two issues which I'll address this morning during the argument, Your Honors. The first issue is whether the trial court clearly erred in finding that the plaintiff presented no evidence of the defendant's negligence in this case under Illinois law. The second issue would be whether the trial court's determination that there was no borrowing lending employment relationship in this matter was correct under the facts of this case and under Illinois law. If there are no questions on the facts, I will move into my first argument. Your Honors, the trial court clearly erred in finding that the plaintiff presented no evidence of the defendant's negligence. The trainer room, when it's used as a trainer, goes outside of standards.
This is similar to the way you put it in your briefs, as if this were on summary judgment. The question is not whether evidence was presented of negligence. The question is whether the district court made a clear error in finding that there was no negligence. We're here after a trial on the merits, not on appeal from denial or summary judgment.
Your Honor, I would submit to the court that the trial court, in its order, designated the fact that there was no evidence presented by the plaintiff regarding the defendant's negligence in this case, and I would submit that there was evidence that the trial court erred.
You're not getting my drift. It doesn't make any difference whether there was evidence of negligence. The question is whether it was clear error to find in favor of the defendant after a full trial on the merits.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would submit to the court that it was error to find in favor of the defendants after the evidence was submitted during the bench trial in this case, specifically addressing the application of Illinois law to the facts of the case and the requirements under premises liability laws as they're governed in Illinois. This trainer, when it's used as a trainer, it has certain exemptions because it has to mimic real-life situations for the cadets to train under.
The site, the stage and all that.
That's correct.
That's the training, not the person. Okay.
That's correct. So we think that when used to train the cadets in the proper docking procedures and so forth of these ships, then it can have certain exceptions to safety standards that are otherwise applicable to public rooms. Public areas. When the government decides that it's going to use this room as assembly hall, then that trainer area should be subject to the same requirements for safety standards that any other assembly room is used for by the government. And those standards are viewed in Illinois by the Supreme Court under sections 343 and 343A of the Restatement of Torts. Which defines the landowner's liability for foreseeable harm, including those situations where the plaintiff recognizes that there's a danger but is for some reason distracted. That's covered in the Supreme Court, for example, the Supreme Court decision of Ward v. Kamen, where there was a cement pillar in front of the entranceway to the store. The customer goes into the store, Mr. Ward, sees the cement pillar, purchases some goods inside the Kmart store, particularly a mirror, that he's carrying outside, and runs right into that pillar that he originally saw and was originally an open and obvious danger. But the exceptions in Illinois provide for those situations where the plaintiff is distracted. Comment F of the restatement is a particularly instructive section, and it's specifically cited in the Supreme Court decisions and other appellate court decisions within the state of Illinois. F, comment F of the restatement deals with two circumstances that are exemplified there, and that was the one of the soda fountain, where the customer walks into the drugstore, steps up onto the platform where the soda fountain is located, has their milkshake or whatever it is they're having there, then is preparing to leave and steps off the platform or trips off the platform, being distracted and not realizing that the platform...
Did your client ever claim to be distracted?
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought she never testified to that.
She absolutely testified to the fact, and that was my point, that she was walking through this room. When she walked into the room, there were four times as many people in this room as was typical for this type of orientation period that she ran. And that's because of the Christmas holidays, and they were speeding up getting these sailors to their billets. As she steps into this room that she was going into for the first time in her career, she had never been in the room, never saw the way out of the room, never observed the trainer, never saw the ledge that we're talking about that separated.
You've conceded it's an open and obvious danger.
I think this is absolutely
an open and obvious. Everything you just said is irrelevant.
Well, except that she's distracted by the sailors who were sitting, as she testified, all over the room, four times as many people in this room, and she has to pick her way through the crowd to get to the front of the room where she's supposed to be giving this discussion. As she gets to the front of the room, and after she finishes picking her way through, she turns, begins speaking, steps back two steps, and falls off of this ledge.
And what was wrong with the district court's conclusion that what occurred was as a result of her own negligence and not because of this distraction issue, which would have, I guess, under Illinois law, raised the duty on the part of the Navy?
The court did not consider the distraction issue. In other words, the court didn't address the fact that she was distracted by this.
But the court specifically held that her injury was the fault of her own, it was not her own fault, her own negligence. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And why was that clearly erroneous, to get back to the standard of review?
That was clearly erroneous because under Illinois law, let me give another example, Schaefer v. Mays. In Schaefer v. Mays, a young man was cutting a hole in a floor area where they were going to install a stairway with his father-in-law in the morning. That afternoon, while he's carrying materials, he steps right into the very hole that he cut because he's distracted by the work that he's performing. And under 343 and 343A, which the court did not consider, these are exceptions to the open and obvious danger. And it's a deliberate encounter, or when they really should have known that danger was there, but are distracted for some reason. And that, in this case, is what Ms. Luna was, what happened with Ms. Luna. She was distracted. She's giving a speech. She's nervous. She's talking to four times as many people as she's ever talked to before in a room that she was unfamiliar with. She picks her way through the crowd, turns, steps back twice as she's speaking, and falls.
Why isn't this claim precluded under the Workers' Compensation Act?
That would be the second point I would be talking about. It's not precluded under the Workers' Compensation Act because it doesn't fall under the Workers' Compensation Act, nor under the Illinois case law that would set this as a borrowing-lending servant relationship. And the trial court correctly determined that there was no borrowing or lending circumstance here. There's two means under Illinois law to determine loan borrowed servant. The first test is fact dependent. It determines whether the lending or purported lending employer is an independent contractor rather than a lending employer. The courts in those cases look to the discipline of the employee, hiring and firing, the degree of supervision, who has the right to control workers, who directs the work being done, the length of service, service performed, command of time, and consent of the relationship. In this case, there's direct testimony from both the RCI representatives and the contract administrators for the government that RCI was responsible for hiring, firing, supervision of its own employees, assigned the jobs of its employees, gave direction to its employees, had total control of its employees, determined the duties of its employees, and decided the number of employees on the site. Now, that particularly an important factor here because, as we'll discuss in Bellarmine, which is a case decided under the second standard as well, the number of employees is a critical issue because usually that's the way these contracts are fulfilled when there's a lending borrowing. In this case, the specific testimony of the contract administrators for the government was that they didn't care how many employees RCI used, they didn't care how many employees it took to get the job done. If they wanted the contract fulfilled and whether RCI had to use more employees than the government for years or less, it was irrelevant.
Is it safe to say that they contracted for a service?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And is that, you're referring to the control test, I guess. Aren't you going to go recite all those things?
Yes.
Would that also fit into the statutory test?
The statutory test is a second level of test, and I would say some of those factors are appropriate under the statutory test.
Well, as far as the lending, you need a contract for a service or for a person. I try to simplify things sometimes. And here it's for the service. If you just send over people, so we need three people, and we're going to have new things, that's the employee, I would assume, versus the service. I just wonder if that distinction is valid in your view.
The control is still a factor under
control. So it's not going to decide all those things under control. But the fact is that they contracted for a service as opposed to something that they were going to then just have several people and they were going to
put
together.
That's correct, Your Honor. When you're contracting for people, you're getting people to do the job, and the borrowing employer is the one that's telling them what to do and how to do it, when to do it, and specifically having supervision and control over those. In the other circumstance, there is none of that control present. But in the second test, where you look to the Workers' Comp Act, as I think Your Honor is also referring to, you have to look to see what the business is of the company that is giving over or providing these services, if it's a manpower type of company, a staff builders type of company that provides temporary workers, then it falls under the Act's provision for borrowing and lending service. On the other hand, as GSSC was in Bellarmine, they were providing specific people for specific jobs, and all of the control was decided by the deputy service rather than GSSC, the people providing the security. So GSSC was in the business of providing people to fulfill jobs of other people rather than providing people to service contracts that were made under the government's contracting. If we look at Bellarmine, I think the facts are distinguishable, but the law, as decided by the Seventh Circuit, is in harmony with this case and the decision of the lower of the district court.
The district court said it was refusing to follow Bellarmine, which seems, insubordinate. District judge has no authority to refuse to follow decisions of this circuit. We may be wrong. Indeed, the Supreme Court of the United States tells us often enough that we're wrong. We do have a hierarchical system.
Your Honor, I think that what the district court was referring to is applying the first test where this was an independent contractor.
Counsel, I don't know why you keep referring to the control test as being the first test. Workers' compensation law is statutory. Why wouldn't we look to the statute for the definition of a loaning and borrowing employer to determine this issue? And you're saying the statutory test is actually the second test. That's turning it upside down.
I wasn't referring to it in terms of some order that the court should follow. I was just trying to distinguish that there are two separate tests. And whether
if the statutory definition is met, then you're out of luck. And the statutory definition here appears to be met. The RCI was in the business of furnishing administrative employees to the Navy, right?
No, RCI, I beg to differ respectfully, Your Honor. RCI was in the business of contracting with the government
to supply employees,
to supply contract services. This was a
consisting of
non-personal services contract. As the government administrators put it, for example, and this exemplifies the point, they didn't get a restaurant, they were a steak. They don't care about how the steak ends up being prepared as they ordered it. They don't care about how many cooks it takes. They don't care about how many chefs it takes to prepare it. They don't care about all the details of this. And in this case, that was the testimony of the contract administrator. They don't have the right to control the employees of RCI.
That's not part of the statutory test.
I would submit that under Illinois law, as the Supreme Court has defined it, the right to control of the statutory test deals with temporary employment services in those kinds of business where the whole business is that. We could use this as an analogy. If you go to a construction site and say that the general contractors contract with all these subcontractors, well, the subcontractors are in the business of contracting there and supplying workers to fulfill jobs. They're performing services. That would be the same situation as we're dealing with here. None of those subcontractors' employees are considered employees of the general contractor simply because there's a contract for services. There has to be much more than that, including the control issue.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Wallace.
May it please the court. I'd first like to augment my brief a little bit on the jurisdictional issue. I cited an Illinois Appellate Court Third Circuit case by the name of Wasluski versus Havi that followed the statutory test that the Illinois Supreme Court has fashioned. Wasluski.
No, you began by referring to a jurisdictional issue.
Yes.
What does that have to do with the Borough Workers Statute?
Well, the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act would determine whether or not...
Yeah, that's a question of substantive liability. What does it have to do with jurisdiction? Jurisdiction in this case is based on 28 U.S.C. 1346, something or other.
Okay, I stand corrected on the Illinois workers' compensation issue. I cited the Illinois Appellate Court Third Circuit case Wasluski at page 21 and 22 of my brief. That followed the statutory test, but Wasluski did not cite Chicago's Finest Workers, which is the Illinois Supreme Court case. Subsequent to Wasluski, and not cited in my brief, is a Third Circuit opinion that was issued by a separate panel of three judges. The judges in Wasluski were judges Stouder, Wambacher, and Scott. And Lampier then was decided by a different panel of judges. And these judges wrote that they were overruling Wasluski. And Judge Pallmeyer had cited Lampier also for the proposition cited in Lampier that it was overruling Wasluski. I looked briefly into it, and I can find no published rules where a panel of three judges of the same district in the Illinois Appellate Court can overrule another panel. I don't think that there are any internal procedures that allow for that. I think they can state that they disagree, but the only people who can overrule the Wasilewski panel would be the Illinois Supreme Court. And so Wasilewski and Lampier are opinions issued by mutually exclusive panels of judges, and they're still citable law. That it reflects merely a disagreement of the judges in that circuit. I think what happened in the Third Circuit, Illinois Appellate Court, is no different than the various decisions by the different panels in the first district that I cited. There were panels that disagreed with each other, but neither opinion can overrule the other panel's decision, and I think that the Lampier language might have been a little bit strong. I would like to address counsel's statement and argument that I had conceded liability in this case. I think the record is pretty clear that nothing could be further from the truth. Defendant's counsel merely reasserts arguments he made in the district court, and he gives no reasons why the district court was wrong when it held that it was a fact that at no point prior to trial did plaintiff's counsel notify the court of the belief that defendant was conceding liability. The court also held that it was a fact that at no point during trial did plaintiff notify the court of its belief that I had conceded liability. And the court also found as a fact that plaintiff never presented a stipulation concerning this matter to the court, which is the usual and customary way of doing this, especially when it's something so serious as a party conceding liability. It's usually in writing, signed by both parties, and it's put on the record. The court also held that it was a fact that plaintiff never attempted in any way whatsoever to make a record concerning any of the alleged agreements, and even though the plaintiff bears the burden. While it's true that plaintiff sent defendant a letter 11 days before trial outlining what he believed to be defendant's position, the court made additional findings that the defendant did deny the contents of plaintiff's letter and denied that they had entered into any agreement not to contest liability. In its written opinion, the court even went so far as to apologize to defendant's counsel for inaccurately stating previously on the record that defendant had not responded to the letter. I'd like to suggest that these apologies are not given frequently. The court also stated that defendant's counsel's refusal to stipulate to certain statements regarding liability submitted in a draft final pretrial order was actually concrete evidence that defendant was not conceding liability. And despite all these rather damning findings, the court found that plaintiff was under a good faith misapprehension and actually allowed the plaintiff to have a subsequent trial, trying to establish that there was some form of negligence, and give anything else that he found during discovery a chance at a second trial. I submit that it's merely that plaintiff doesn't like the result, and that's merely the risk of trial. To respond to Judge Sykes, there was an absolute finding by the court that there was no evidence that demonstrated that plaintiff was distracted. She had, the judge had considered that and made a finding based on numerous facts, and I think that's her opinion that's attached to plaintiff's brief. If there's nothing else,
Well, I'd like to just clarify a little bit here. As this thing stems from your point of view, at least, workers' compensation, as I understand it. And I'm wondering, as far as the test to determine what the status was, what do you call her?
I maintain that RCI and the Navy met the statutory test that we find in Chicago's Finest Workers case, the Illinois Supreme Court case, that was adopted by this court in the Bellamini case and applied to Bellamini. And if there was ever a case that cried out for sympathy or some way to find in favor of a particular plaintiff, it was certainly Officer Bellamini who gave his life that day protecting this very courthouse. And the court found that based on the statutory test, there was a relationship between the company and a contract between the company that was supplying deputy U.S. Marshals to the Marshals Service. And that was enough. That statutory test where they were hiring and procuring employees to work for another employer, that was enough, and you didn't have to go any further. I think the Illinois Supreme Court is clear on that, and it's been clear on that since 1975. I think a lot of these decisions in the Illinois Appellate Court, where they're varying, I try to try to figure out why that's happening, and many times I see, as in the Wasilewski case and Lampier case, they're not citing Chicago Finest Works and workers, and I think that might be because of the fact that counsel that are appearing before those judges are not citing the lead case, so everybody either doesn't know or is not mentioning the controlling law in those Illinois appellate court cases.
Well, in your view, was RCI providing a person, an employee, or a service?
It is similar to what was happening in Bellamini. It had a contract to supply, to actually hire and procure employees to do the personnel human resources services for the Navy. And the Navy was very specific and controlling in that contract as to exactly what they were to perform, how they were to perform it, the code of ethics for each employee, the code of conduct for each employee, the dress code for each employee, not to mention all of the of Title V that applies to these military personnel. The Navy was downsizing and needed to fill certain very specific positions with their civil service staff. Resource Consultants was an employer whose business consisted of hiring and procuring and furnishing and even training employees to do other employees' work. The Navy and RCI entered into that contract where RCI agreed to fill certain positions within the Navy formerly done by civilian Navy personnel and to process Navy recruits from a human resource perspective at Great Lakes Naval Base. It was a detailed, lengthy contract wherein the Navy provided very explicit job descriptions and duties and otherwise dictated within the contract precisely the actions of the employees furnished by RCI.
Counsel, you would agree, though, that the degree of control is not a component of the definition. So if the statutory definition is satisfied, that's the end of it.
That's correct. That's my belief, yes. That's correct. That's the Illinois Supreme Court in this case, this court's case in Bellamini. That is absolutely correct. Is there anything else? Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.